From the rasping sound, she knew that she, too, would soon see the giant worm. Shiana did not think of the approaching monster as Shai-Hulud, god of the sands, a thing the priests chanted each morning in obeisance to the pearl of Leto II's awareness that lay encapsulated in each of the multi-ridged rulers of the desert. She thought of the worms mainly as they who spared me, or as Shaitan. They belonged to her now. It was a relationship begun slightly more than 3 years ago during the month of her 8th birthday, the month Agat, by the old calendar. Her village had been a poor one, a pioneer venture built far beyond more secure barriers, such as the kanats and ring canals of Keen. Only a moat of damp sand guarded such pioneer places. Shaitan avoided water, but the sand trout vectors soon took away any dampness. Precious moisture captured in wind traps had to be expended each day to renew the barrier. Her village was a miserable cluster of shacks and hovels with two small wind traps, adequate for drinking water, but with only a sporadic surplus that could be apportioned to the worm barrier. That morning, much like this morning, the night's chill sharp in her nose and lungs, the horizon constricted by a ghostly haze, most of the village children had fanned out into the desert, there to seek bits and fragments of melange, which Shaitan sometimes left behind in his passage. Two big ones had been heard nearby in the night. Melange, even at modern deflated prices, could buy the glazed bricks to line a third wind trap. Each searching child not only looked for the spice, but also sought those signs which would reveal one of the old Fremen CH strongholds. There were only remnants of such places now, but the rock barriers provided a greater security against Shaitan. And some of the remnant CH places were reputed to contain lost hordes of melange. Every villager dreamed of such a discovery. Shiana, wearing her patched stillsuit and flimsy robe, went alone to the northeast, toward the faraway smoky mound of air that told of the great city of Keen, with its moisture richness lifting into the sun-warmed breezes. Hunting scraps of melange in the sand was largely a matter of focusing attention into the nostrils. It was a form of concentration that left only bits of awareness attuned to the rasping sand that told of Shaitan's approach. Leg muscles worked automatically in the non-rhythmic walk that blended with the desert's natural sounds. At first, Shiana did not hear the screaming. It fitted intimately into the saltated friction of wind-blown sand across the barricades that concealed the village from her right. Slowly the sound penetrated her consciousness, and then it demanded her attention. Many voices screaming. Shiana discarded the desert precaution of random strides. Moving swiftly as her childish muscles would carry her, she scrambled up the slip face of the barrican and stared along it toward that terrifying sound. She was in time to see that which cut off the last of the screams. Wind and sand trout had dried a wide arc of the barrier at the far side of her village. She could see the gap by the color difference. A wild worm had penetrated the opening. It circled close inside the remaining dampness. The gigantic flame-shadowed mouth scooped up people and hovels in a swiftly tightening circle. Shiana saw the last survivors huddled at the center of this destruction, a space already cleared of its rude hovels and tumbled with the remains of the wind traps. Even as she watched, some of the people tried to break away into the desert. Shiana recognized her father among the frantic runners. None escaped. The great mouth engulfed all before turning to level the last of the village. Smoking sand remained, and nothing else of the puny village that had dared to claim a scrap of Shaitan's domain. The place where the village had been was as unmarked by human habitation as it had been before anyone walked there. Shiana took a gasping breath, inhaling through her nose to preserve the moisture of her body, as any good child of the desert would do. She scanned the horizon for a sign of the other children, but Shaitan's track had left great curves and loops all around the far side of the village. Not a single human remained in view. She shouted, the high-pitched cry that would carry far through the dry air. No response came back to her. Alone. She moved trance-like along the ridge of the dune toward where her village had been. As she neared the place, a great wave of cinnamon odor filled her nostrils, carried on the wind that still dusted the tops of the dunes. She realized then what had happened. The village had been sighted disastrously atop a pre-spice blow. As the great horde far under the sand came to fruition, expanding in an explosion of melange, Shaitan had come. Every child knew Shaitan could not resist a spice blow. Rage and wild desperation began to fill Shiana. Mindlessly, she raced down the dune toward Shaitan, coming up behind the worm as it turned back through the dry place where it had entered the village. Without thought, she dashed along beside the tail, scrambled onto it, and ran forward along the great ridged back. At the hump behind its mouth, she crouched and beat her fists against the unyielding surface. The worm stopped. Her anger suddenly converted to terror, Shiana broke off pounding on the worm. She realized only then that she had been screaming. A terrible sense of lonely exposure filled her. She did not know how she had come here. She knew only where she was, and this gripped her with an agony of fear. The worm continued quiescent on the sand. Shiana did not know what to do. At any moment, the worm could roll over and crush her, or it could burrow beneath the sand, leaving her on the surface to be scooped up at leisure. Abruptly, a long tremor worked its way down the worm's length from its tail to Shiana's position behind the mouth. The worm began to move ahead. It turned in a wide arc and gathered speed on a course to the northeast. Shiana leaned forward and gripped the leading edge of a ring ridge on the worm's back. She feared that any second it would slide beneath the sand. What could she do then? But Shaitan did not burrow. As minutes passed, without any deviation from that straight and swift passage across the dunes, Shiana found her mind working once more. She knew about this ride. The priests of the divided god forbade it, but the histories, both written and oral, said Fremen rode thus in the ancient days. Fremen stood tall atop Shaitan's back, supported by slender poles with hooked ends. The priests decreed that this had been done before Leto II shared his consciousness with the god of the desert. Now nothing was permitted that might demean the scattered bits of Leto II. With a speed that astonished her, the worm carried Shiana toward the mist-dazzled shape of Keen. The great city lay like a mirage on the distorted horizon. Shiana's threadbare robe whipped against the thin surface of her patched stillsuit. Her fingers ached where she gripped the leading edge of the giant ring. The cinnamon, burnt rock, and ozone of the worm's heat exchange swept over her on shifts in the wind. Keen began to gain definition ahead of her. "The priests will see me and be angry," she thought. She identified the low brick structures that mark the first line of Kanats, and beyond them the enclosed barrel curve of a surface aqueduct. Above these structures rose the walls of terraced gardens and the high profiles of giant wind traps, then the temple complex within its own water barriers. A day's march across open sand in little more than an hour. Her parents and village neighbors had made this journey many times for trade and to join in the dancing, but Shiana had only accompanied them twice. She remembered mostly the dancing and the violence that followed. The size of Keen filled her with awe. So many buildings, so many people. Shaitan could not harm such a place as that. But the worm plunged straight ahead, as though it would ride over a Kanat and aqueduct. Shiana stared at the city rising higher and higher in front of her. Fascination subdued her terror. Shaitan was not going to stop. The worm ground to a halt. The tubular surface vents of the Kanat lay no more than 50 meters in front of its gaping mouth. She smelled the hot cinnamon exhalations, heard the deep rumblings of Shaitan's interior furnace. It became apparent to her at last that the journey had ended. Slowly, Shiana released her grip on the ring. She stood, expecting any moment that the worm would renew its motion. Shaitan remained quiescent. Moving cautiously, she slid off her perch and dropped to the sand. She paused there. Would it move now? She held a vague idea of dashing for the Kanat, but this worm fascinated her. Slipping and sliding in the disturbed sand, Shiana moved around to the front of the worm and stared into the fearsome mouth. Within the frame of crystal teeth, flames rolled forward and backward. A searing exhalation of spice odors swept over her. The madness of that first dash down off the dune and onto the worm came back to Shiana. "Damn you, Shaitan!" she shouted, shaking a fist at the awful mouth. "What did we ever do to you?" These were words she had heard her mother use at the destruction of a tuber garden. No part of Shiana's awareness had ever questioned that name, Shaitan, nor her mother's fury. She was of the poorest dregs at the bottom of the Rakian heap, and she knew it. Her people believed in Shaitan first, and Shai-Hulud second. Worms were worms, and often much worse. There was no justice on the open sand. Only danger lurked there. Poverty and fear of priests might drive her people onto the perilous dunes, but they moved even then with the same angry persistence that had driven the Fremen. This time, however, Shaitan had won. It entered Shiana's awareness that she stood in the deadly path. Her thoughts, not yet fully formed, recognized only that she had done a crazy thing. Much later, as the sisterhood's teachings rounded her consciousness, she would realize that she had been overcome by the terror of loneliness. She had wanted Shaitan to take her into the company of her dead. A grating sound issued from beneath the worm. Shiana stifled the scream. Slowly at first, then faster, the worm backed off several meters. It turned there and gathered speed beside the twin-mounded track it had created coming from the desert. The grating of its passage diminished in the distance. Shiana grew aware of another sound. She lifted her gaze to the sky. The thwack-thwack of a priestly ornithopter swept over her, brushing her with its shadow. The craft glistened in the morning sunlight as it followed the worm into the desert. Shiana felt a more familiar fear then. The priests. She kept her gaze on the thopter. It hovered in the distance, then returned to settle gently onto a patch of worm-smoothed sand nearby. She could smell the lubricants and the sickly acridity of the thopter's fuel. The thing was a giant insect nestled on the sand, waiting to pounce upon her. A hatch popped open. Shiana threw back her shoulders and stood her ground. Very well, they had caught her. She knew what to expect now. Nothing could be gained by flight. Only the priests used thopters. They could go anywhere and see anything. Two richly robed priests, their garments all gold and white with purple trim, emerged and ran toward her across the sand. They knelt in front of Shiana so close she could smell their perspiration and the musky melange incense which permeated their clothing. They were young, but much like all the priests she could remember. Softer features, uncalloused hands, careless of their moisture losses. Neither of them wore a stillsuit under those robes. The one on her left, his eyes on a level with Shiana's, spoke. "Child of Shai-Hulud, we saw your father bring you from his lands." The words made no sense to Shiana. Priests were meant to be feared. Her parents and all the adults she had ever known had impressed this upon her by words and actions. Priests possessed ornithopters. Priests fed you to Shaitan for the slightest infraction, or for no infraction at all, for only priestly whims. Her people knew many instances. Shiana backed away from the kneeling men and cast her glance around. Where could she run? The one who had spoken raised an imploring hand. "Stay with us." You're bad! Shiana's voice cracked with emotion. Both priests fell prostrate on the sand. Far away on the city's towers, sunlight flashed off lenses. Shiana saw them. She knew about such flashings. Priests were always watching you in the cities. When you saw the lenses flash, that was the signal to be inconspicuous, to be good. Shiana clasped her hands in front of her to still their trembling. She glanced left and right, and then at the prostrate priests. Something was wrong here. Heads on the sand, the two priests shuddered with fear and waited. Neither spoke. Shiana did not know how to respond. The crush of her immediate experiences could not be absorbed by an 8-year-old mind. She knew that her parents and all of her neighbors had been taken by Shaitan. Her own eyes had witnessed this, and Shaitan had brought her here, refusing to take her into his awful fires. She had been spared. This was a word she understood. Spared. It had been explained to her when she learned the dancing song. Shaihulud, spare us. Take Shaitan away. Slowly, not wanting to arouse the prostrate priests, Shiana began the shuffling, unrhythmic movements of the dance. As the remembered music grew within her, she unclasped her hands and swung her arms wide. Her feet lifted high in the stately movements. Her body turned, slowly at first, and then more swiftly as the dance ecstasy increased. Her long brown hair whipped around her face. The two priests dared to lift their heads. The strange child was performing the dance. They recognized the movements. The dance of propitiation. She asked Shaihulu to forgive his people. She asked God to forgive them. They turned their heads to look at each other, and together rocked back onto their knees. There they began clapping in the time-honored effort to distract the dancer. Their hands clapped rhythmically as they chanted the ancient words. Our fathers ate manna in the desert, in the burning places where whirlwinds came. The priests excluded from their attention all except the child. She was a slender thing, they saw, with stringy muscles, thin arms, and legs. Her robe and stillsuit were worn and patched like those of the poorest. Her cheekbones had high planes that drew shadows across her olive skin. Brown eyes, they noted. Reddish sun streaks drew their lines in her hair. There was a water-spare sharpness about her features, the narrow nose and chin, the wide forehead, the wide, thin mouth, the long neck. She looked like the Fremen portraits in the Holy of Holies at Dar es Balat. Of course, the child of Shaihulud would look thus. She danced well, too. Not the slightest, quickly repeatable rhythm entered her movements. There was rhythm, but it was an admirably long beat, at least 100 steps apart. She kept it up while the sun lifted higher and higher. It was almost noon before she fell exhausted to the sand. The priest stood and looked out into the desert where Shaihulud had gone. The stampings of the dance had not summoned him back. They were forgiven. That was how Shiana's new life began. Loudly, in their own quarters, and for many days, the senior priests engaged in arguments about her. At last, they brought their disputations and reports to the high priest, Hedley Tuwek. They met in the afternoon within the Hall of Small Convocations, Tuwek and 6 priestly counselors. Murals of Leto II, a human face on the great worm shape, looked down upon them with benevolence. Tuwek seated himself on a stone bench that had been recovered from Windgap CH. Moadib himself was reputed to have sat on this bench. One of the legs still bore the carvings of an Atreides hawk. His counselors took lesser modern benches facing him. The high priest was an imposing figure, silky gray hair combed smoothly to his shoulders. It was a suitable frame for the square face with its wide, thick mouth and heavy chin. Tuwek's eyes retained their original clear whites, surrounding dark blue pupils. Bushy, untrimmed gray eyebrows shaded his eyes. The counselors were a motley lot, scions of old priestly families. Each carried in his heart the belief that matters would move better if he were sitting on Tuwek's bench. The scrawny, pinch-faced Sturrows put himself forward as opposition spokesman. "She is nothing but a poor desert waif, and she rode Shai-Hulud. That is forbidden, and the punishment is mandatory." Others spoke up immediately. "No! No, Sturrows. You have it wrong. She did not stand on Shai-Hulud's back as the Fremen did. She had no maker hooks or..." Sturrows tried to shout them down. It was deadlock, Tuwek saw. 3-3, with Umfrid, a fat hedonist, as advocate for cautious acceptance. "She had no way to guide Shai-Hulud's course," Umfrid argued. "We all saw how she came down to the sand, unafraid, and talked to him." Yes, they all had seen that, either at the moment or in the holophoto that a thoughtful observer had recorded. Desert waif or not, she had confronted Shai-Hulud and conversed with him. And Shai-Hulud had not engulfed her. No, indeed. The worm of God had drawn back at the child's command, and had returned to the desert. "We will test her," Tuwek said. Early the following morning, an ornithopter flown by the two priests who had brought her from the desert conveyed Shiana far out away from the sight of Keen's populace. The priests took her down to a dune top and planted a meticulous copy of a Fremen thumper in the sand. When the thumper's catch was released, a heavy beating trembled through the desert, the ancient summons to Shai-Hulud. The priests fled to their thopter and waited high overhead while the terrified Shiana, her worst fears realized, stood alone some 20 meters from the thumper. Two worms came. They were not the largest the priests had ever seen, no more than 30 meters long. One of them scooped up the thumper and silenced it. Together they rounded in parallel tracks and stopped side by side, not 6 meters from Shiana. She stood submissive, fists clenched at her sides. This was what priests did. They fed you to Shaitan. In their hovering thopter, the two priests watched with fascination. Their lenses transmitted the scene to equally fascinated observers in the high priest's quarters at Keen. All of them had seen similar events before. It was a standard punishment, a handy way to remove obstructionists from the populace or priesthood, or to pave the way for acquisition of a new concubine. Never before, though, had they seen a lone child as victim. And such a child. The worms of God crept forward slowly after their first stop. They became motionless once more, when only about 3 meters from Shiana. Resigned to her fate, Shiana did not run. Soon she thought she would be with her parents and friends. As the worms remained motionless, anger replaced her terror. The bad priests had left her here. She could hear their thopter overhead. The hot spice smell from the worms filled the air around her. Abruptly, she raised her right hand and pointed up at the thopter. "Go ahead and eat me. That's what they want." The priests overhead could not hear her words, but the gesture was visible, and they could see that she was talking to the two worms of God. The finger pointing up at them did not bode well. The worms did not move. Shiana lowered her hand. "You killed my mother and father and all my friends," she accused. She took a step forward and shook a fist at them. The worms retreated, keeping their distance. "If you don't want me, go back where you came from." She waved them away toward the desert. Obediently, they backed farther and turned in unison. The priests in the thopter tracked them until they slipped beneath the sand more than a kilometer away. Only then did the priests return, fear and trepidation in them. They plucked the child of Shai-Hulud from the sand and returned her to Keen. The Bene Gesserit embassy at Keen had a full report by nightfall. word was on its way to the chapter house by the following morning. It had happened at last. The trouble with some kinds of warfare, and be certain the tyrant knew this, because it is implicit in his lesson, is that they destroy all moral decency in susceptible types. Warfare of these kinds will dump the destroyed survivors back into an innocent population that is incapable of even imagining what such returned soldiers might do. Teachings of the Golden Path, Bene Gesserit Archives. One of Miles Tegg's early memories was of sitting at dinner with his parents and his younger brother, Sabine. Tegg had been only 7 at the time, but the events lay indelibly in his memory. The dining room on Lernaeus colorful with freshly cut flowers. The low light of the yellow sun diffused by antique shades. Bright blue dinnerware and glistening silver graced the table. Acolyte servants stood ready at hand, because his mother might be permanently detached on special duty. But her function as a Bene Gesserit teacher was not to be wasted. Janet Roxborough Tegg, a large-boned woman who appeared cast for the part of Grande Dame, looked down her nose from one end of the table, watching that the dinner service not be impaired by the slightest misplacement. Lurshi Tegg, Miles's father, always observed this with a faint air of amusement. He was a thin man with high forehead, a face so narrow his dark eyes appeared to bulge at the sides. His black hair was a perfect counterpoint for his wife's fairness. Above the subdued sounds at the table, and the rich smell of spiced Idu soup, his mother instructed his father on how to deal with an importunate free trader. When she said, "Tlilaxu," she had Miles's entire attention. His education had just recently touched on the Beni Tlilax. Even Sabine, who succumbed many years later to a poisoner on Romo, listened with as much of his 4-year-old awareness as he could muster. Sabine hero-worshipped his brother. Anything that caught the attention of Miles was of interest to Sabine. Both boys listened silently. "The man is fronting for the Tlilazu," Lady Janet said. "I can hear it in his voice." "I do not doubt your ability to detect such things, my dear," Lurshi Tegg said. "But what am I to do? He has the proper tokens of credit, and he wishes to buy the..." "The order for the rice is unimportant at the moment. Never assume that what a face dancer appears to seek is actually what it seeks." "I'm sure he's not a face dancer. He..." "Lurshi! I know you have learned this well at my instruction, and can detect a face dancer. I agree that the free trader is not one of them. The face dancers remain on his ship. They know I am here." "They know they could not fool you." "Yes, but Tlilazu's strategy is always woven within a web of strategies, any one of which may be the real strategy. They learn that from us." "My dear, if we are dealing with Tlilazu, and I do not question your judgment, then it immediately becomes a question of melange." Lady Janet nodded her head gently. Indeed, even Miles knew about the Tlilazu connection with the spice. It was one of the things that fascinated him about the Tlilazu. For every milligram of melange produced on Rakis, the Beni Tlilax tanks produced long tons. Use of melange had grown to fit the new supply, and even the spacing guild bent its knee before this power. "But the rice," Lurshi Tegg ventured. "My dear husband, the Beni Tlilax have no need of that much pongee rice in our sector. They require it for trade. We must find out who really needs the rice." "You want me to delay," he said. "Precisely. You are superb at what we now require. Don't give that free trader the chance to say yes or no. Someone trained by the face dancers will appreciate such subtlety. We lure the face dancers out of the ship while you initiate inquiries elsewhere. Lady Janet smiled. "You are lovely when you leap ahead of me that way." A look of understanding passed between them. "We cannot go to another supplier in this sector," Loshi Teg said. "He will wish to avoid a go-no-go confrontation," Lady Janet said, patting the table. "Delay, delay, and more delay. You must draw the face dancers out of the ship. They will realize, of course." "Yes, my dear, and it is dangerous. You must always meet on your own ground, and with your own guards nearby." Miles Teg recalled that his father had indeed drawn the face dancers out of their ship. His mother had taken Miles to the viewer, where he watched the copper-walled room in which his father drove the bargain that won Chom's highest commendation and a rich bonus. The first face dancers Miles Teg ever saw. Two small men as alike as twins. Almost chinless round faces, pug noses, tiny mouths, black button eyes, and short cropped white hair that stood up from their heads like the bristles on a brush. The two were dressed as the free trader had been, black tunics and trousers. "Illusion, Miles," his mother said. "Illusion is their way. The fashioning of illusion to achieve real goals. That is how the Tlelazu work." "Like the magician at the winter show?" Miles asked, his gaze intent on the viewer and its toy figure scene. "Quite similar," his mother agreed. She too watched the viewer as she spoke, but one arm went protectively around her son's shoulders. "You are looking at evil, Miles. Study it carefully. The faces you see can be changed in an instant. They can grow taller, appear heavier. They could mimic your father so that only I would recognize the substitution." Miles Teg's mouth formed a soundless O. He stared at the viewer, listening to his father explain that the price of Chom's pongee rice once more had gone up alarmingly. "And the most terrible thing of all," his mother said, "some of the newer face dancers can, by touching the flesh of a victim, absorb some of the victim's memories." "They read minds?" Miles looked up at his mother. "Not exactly. We think they take a print of the memories, almost a holophoto process. They do not yet know that we are aware of this." Miles understood. He was not to speak of this to anyone, not even to his father or his mother. She had taught him the Bene Gesserit way of secrecy. He watched the figures in the screen with care. At his father's words, the face dancers betrayed no emotion, but their eyes appeared to glitter more brightly. "How did they get so evil?" Miles asked. "They are communal beings, bred not to identify with any shape or face. The appearance they present now is for my benefit. They know I am watching. They have relaxed into their natural communal shape. Mark it closely." Miles tipped his head to one side and studied the face dancers. They looked so bland and ineffectual. "They have no sense of self," his mother said. "They have only the instinct to preserve their own lives unless ordered to die for their masters." "Would they do that?" "They have done it many times." "Who are their masters?" "Men who seldom leave the planets of the Bene Tlilax." "Do they have children?" "Not face dancers. They are mules, sterile. But their masters can breed. We have taken a few of them, but the offspring are strange. Few female births, and even then we cannot probe their other memories." Miles frowned. He knew his mother was a Bene Gesserit. He knew the Reverend Mothers carried a marvelous reservoir of other memories going back through all the millennia of the sisterhood. He even knew something of the Bene Gesserit breeding design. Reverend Mothers chose particular men and had children by those men. "What are the Tlelazu women like?" Miles asked. It was a perceptive question that sent a surge of pride through the Lady Janet. Yes, it was almost a certainty that she had a potential mentat here. the breeding mistresses have been right about the gene potential of Loshiteg. No one outside of their planets has ever reported seeing a Tlilazu female, the Lady Janet said. Do they exist, or is it just the tanks? They exist. Are any of the face dancers women? At their own choice, they can be male or female. Observe them carefully. They know what your father is doing, and it angers them. Will they try to hurt my father? They don't dare. We have taken precautions, and they know it. See how the one on the left works his jaws? That is one of their anger signs. You said they were communal beings. Like hive insects, Miles. They have no self-image. Without a sense of self, they go beyond amorality. Nothing they say or do can be trusted. Miles shuddered. We have never been able to detect an ethical code in them, the Lady Janet said. They are flesh made into automata. Without self, they have nothing to esteem or even doubt. They are bred only to obey their masters. And they were told to come here and buy the rice. Exactly. They were told to get it, and there's no other place in this sector where they can do that. They must buy it from Father? He's their only source. At this very moment, son, they are paying in melange. You see? Miles saw the orange-brown spice markers change hands, a tall stack of them, which one of the face dancers removed from a case on the floor. The price is far, far higher than they ever anticipated, the Lady Janet said. This will be an easy trail to follow. Why? Someone will be bankrupted acquiring that shipment. We think we know who the buyer is. Whoever it is, we will learn of it. Then we will know what was really being traded here. Lady Janet then began to point out the identifiable incongruities that betrayed a face dancer to trained eyes and ears. They were subtle signs, but Miles picked up on them immediately. His mother told him then that she thought he might become a mentat, perhaps even more. Shortly before his 13th birthday, Miles Teg was sent away to advance schooling at the Bene Gesserit stronghold on Lampadas, where his mother's assessment of him was confirmed. Word went back to her, "You have given us the warrior mentat we had hoped for." Teg did not see this note until sorting through his mother's effects after her death. The words inscribed on a small sheet of Redulian crystal with the chapter house imprint below them filled him with an odd sense of displacement in time. His memory put him suddenly back on Lampadas, where the love awe he had felt for his mother was deftly transferred to the sisterhood itself, as originally intended. He had come to understand this only during his later mentat training, but the understanding changed little. If anything, it bound him even more strongly to the Bene Gesserit. It confirmed that the sisterhood must be one of his strengths. He already knew that the Bene Gesserit sisterhood was one of the most powerful forces in his universe, equal at least to the Spacing Guild, superior to the Fish Speaker Council that had inherited the core of the old Atreides Empire, superior by far to Chome, and balanced somehow with the fabricators of Ix and with the Bene Tlilax. A small measure of the sisterhood's far-reaching authority could be deduced from the fact that they held this authority despite Tlilazu tank-grown melange, which had broken the Raikian monopoly on the spice, just as Ixian navigation machines had broken the guild monopoly on space travel. Miles Teg knew his history well by then. Guild navigators no longer were the only ones who could thread a ship through the folds of space. In this galaxy one instant, in a faraway galaxy the very next heartbeat. The school sisters held back little from him, revealing there for the first time the fact of his Atreides ancestry. That revelation was necessary because of the tests they gave him. They obviously were testing for prescience. Could he, like a guild navigator, detect fatal obstructions? He failed. They tried him next on no chambers and no ships. He was as blind to such devices as the rest of humankind. For this test, though, they fed him increased doses of the spice, and he sensed the awakening of his true self. The mind at its beginning, a teaching sister called it when he asked for an explanation of this odd sensation. For a time, the universe was magical as he looked at it through this new awareness. His awareness was a circle, then a globe. Arbitrary forms became transient. He fell into trance state without warning until the sisters taught him how to control this. They provided him with accounts of saints and mystics and forced him to draw a freehand circle with either hand, following the line with his awareness. By the end of the term, his awareness resumed its touch with conventional labels. But the memory of the magic never left him. He found that memory a source of strength at the most difficult moments. After accepting the assignment as weapons master to the Gola, Teg found his magical memory increasingly with him. It was especially useful during his first interview with Shuang Yu at the keep on Gamu. They met in the Reverend Mother's study, a place of shiny metal walls and numerous instruments, most of them with the stamp of Ix on them. Even the chair in which she sat, the morning sun coming through a window behind her and making her face difficult to see, even that chair was one of the Ixian self-molders. He was forced to sit in a chair dog, though he realized she must know he detested the use of any life form for such a demeaning task.
"You were chosen because you actually are a grandfatherly figure," Shuang Yu said.
The bright sunlight formed a corona around her hooded head. Deliberate.
"Your wisdom will earn the child's love and respect." "There's no way I could be a father figure." "According to Taraza, you have the precise characteristics she requires. I know of your honorable scars and their value to us."
This only reconfirmed his previous mentat summation. They have been planning this for a long time. They have bred for it. I was bred for it. I am part of their larger plan. All he said was, "Taraza expects this child to become a redoubtable warrior when restored to his true self." Shuang Yu merely stared at him for a moment, then,
"You must not answer any of his questions about Golas, should he encounter the subject. Do not even use the word until I give you permission. We will supply you with all the Gola data your duties require."
Coldly parceling out his words for emphasis, Teg said,
"Perhaps the Reverend Mother was not informed that I am well versed in the lore of Tlelazu Golas. I have met Tlelazu in battle." "You think you know enough about the Idaho series?" "The Idahos are reputed to have been brilliant military strategists," Teg said. "Then perhaps the great Bashar was not informed about the other characteristics of our Gola."
No doubt of the mockery in her voice. Something else as well. Jealousy and great anger poorly concealed. Teg's mother had taught him ways of reading through her own masks, a forbidden teaching, which he had always concealed. He feigned chagrin and shrugged. It was obvious, though, that Shuang Yu knew he was Taraza's Bashar. The lines had been drawn.
"At Bene Gesserit behest," Shuang Yu said, "the Tlelazu have made a significant alteration in the present Idaho series. His nerve muscle system has been modernized."
Without changing the original persona, Teg fed the question to her blandly, wondering how far she would go in revelation.
"He is a Gola, not a clone."
"I see."
"Do you really? He requires the most careful Prane Bindu training at all stages."
"Taraza's orders exactly," Teg said. "And we will all obey those orders." Shuang Yu leaned forward, not concealing her anger.
"You have been asked to train a Gola whose role in certain plans is most dangerous to us all. I don't think you even remotely understand what you will train. What you will train, Teg thought. Not whom. This Gola child would never be a whom for Shuang Yu, or any of the others who opposed Terraza. Perhaps the Gola would not be a whom to anyone until restored to his original self, firmly seated in that original Duncan, Idaho identity. Teg saw clearly now that Shuang Yu harbored more than hidden reservations about the Gola project. She was in active opposition, just as Terraza had warned. Shuang Yu was the enemy, and Terraza's orders had been explicit. You will protect that child against any threat. 10,000 years since Leto II began his metamorphosis from human into the sandworm of Rakkus, and historians still argue over his motives. Was he driven by the desire for long life? He lived more than 10 times the normal span of 300 SY, but considered the price he paid. Was it the lure of power? He is called the tyrant for good reason, but what did power bring him that a human might want? Was he driven to save humankind from itself? We have only his own words about his golden path to answer this, and I cannot accept the self-serving records of Daras Balat. Might there have been other gratifications which only his experiences would illuminate? Without better evidence, the question is moot. We are reduced to saying only that he did it. The physical fact alone is undeniable. The metamorphosis of Leto II. 10,000th anniversary peroration by Gaius Endod. Once more, Waf knew he was on Lashkar. This time, the stakes were as high as they could go. An honored mater from the scattering demanded his presence. A Pawinda of Pawindas. Descendants of Tlilazu from the scattering had told him all they could about these terrible women. Far more terrible than reverend mothers of the Bene Gesserit, they said. And more numerous, Waf reminded himself. He did not fully trust the returned Leilazu descendants, either. Their accents were strange, their manners even stranger, and their observances of the rituals questionable. How could they be readmitted to the Great Kel? What possible rite of Gufran could cleanse them after all these centuries? It was beyond belief that they had kept the Leilazu secret down the generations. They were no longer Malik brothers, and yet they were the only source of information that Tlilazu possessed about these returning lost ones, and the revelations they had brought. Revelations that had been incorporated in the Duncan, Idaho Golas. That was worth all of the risks of contamination by Pawinda evil. The meeting place with the honored maters was the presumed neutrality of an Ixian no-ship that held a tight orbit around a mutually selected gas giant planet in a mined-out solar system of the old Imperium. The Prophet himself had drained the last of the wealth from this system. New face dancers walked as Ixians among the no-ship's crew, but Waf still sweated the first encounter. If these honored maters were truly more terrible than the Bene Gesserit witches, would the exchange of face dancers for Ixian crewmen be detected? Selection of this meeting place and the arrangements had put a strain on the Tlilazu. Was it secure? He reassured himself that he carried 2 sealed weapons never before seen off the Tlilazu core planets. The weapons were the painstaking result of long effort by his artificers. 2 minuscule dart throwers concealed in his sleeves. He had trained with them for years until the flipping of the sleeves and the discharge of the poison darts was almost an instinctive reflex. The walls of the meeting room were properly copper-toned, evidence that they were shielded from Ixian spy devices. But what instruments might the people of the scattering have developed beyond the Ixian ken? Waf entered the room with a hesitant step. The honored mater already was there, seated in a leather sling chair. You will call me what everyone else calls me, she greeted him. Honored Mater. He bowed as he had been warned to do.
Honored Mater.
No hint of hidden powers in her voice. A low contralto with overtones that spoke of disdain for him. She looked like an aged athlete or acrobat, slowed and retired, but still maintaining her muscle tone and some of her skills. Her face was tight skin over a skull with prominent cheekbones. The thin-lipped mouth produced a sense of arrogance when she spoke, as though every word were projected downward onto lesser folk.
"Well, come in and sit down," she commanded, waving at a sling chair facing her.
Wap heard the hatch hiss closed behind him. He was alone with her. She was wearing a snooper. He could see the lead for it going into her left ear. His dart throwers had been sealed and washed against snoopers, then maintained at -340 degrees Kelvin in a radiation bath for 5 SY to make them proof against snoopers. Had it been enough? Gently, he lowered himself into the indicated chair. Orange-tinted contact lenses covered the Honored Mater's eyes, giving them a feral appearance. She was altogether daunting. And her clothing. Red leotards beneath a dark blue cape. The surface of the cape had been decorated with some pearly material to produce strange arabesques and dragon designs. She sat in the chair as though it were a throne, her claw-like hands resting easily on the arms. Waff glanced around the room. His people had inspected this place in company with Ixion maintenance workers and representatives of the Honored Mater. We have done our best, he thought, and he tried to relax. The Honored Mater laughed. Waff stared at her with as calm an expression as he could muster.
You are gauging me now, he accused. You say to yourself that you have enormous resources to employ against me. Subtle and gross instruments to carry out your commands.
Do not take that tone with me. The words were low and flat, but carried such a weight of venom that Waff almost recoiled. He stared at the stringy muscles of the woman's legs, that deep red leotard fabric which flowed over her skin, as though it were organic to her. Their meeting time had been adjusted to bring them together at a mutually personal mid-morning, their waking hours having been balanced en route. Waff felt dislocated, though, and at a disadvantage. What if the stories of his informants were true? She must have weapons here. She smiled at him without humor.
You are trying to intimidate me, Waff said.
And succeeding. Anger surged through Waff. He kept this from his voice.
I have come at your invitation. I hope you did not come to engage in a confrontation that you would surely lose, she said. I came to forge a bond between us, he said. And he wondered, what do they need from us? Surely they must need something. What bond can there be between us, she asked. Would you build an edifice on a disintegrating raft? Agreements can be broken and often are. For what tokens do we bargain? He asked. Bargain? I do not bargain. I am interested in this gola you made for the witches. Her tone gave away nothing, but Wav's heartbeat quickened at her question. In one of his Gola lifetimes, Waff had trained under a renegade Mentat. The capabilities of a Mentat were beyond him, and besides, reasoning required words. They had been forced to kill the Pawinda Mentat, but there had been some things of value in the experience. Waff allowed himself a small moo of distaste at the memory, but he recalled the things of value. Attack and absorb the data that attack produces. You offer me nothing in exchange, he said, his voice loud.
Recompense is at my discretion, she said. Waff produced a scornful gaze.
Do you play with me? She showed white teeth in a feral grin. You would not survive my play, nor want to. So I must be dependent upon your goodwill. Dependency. The word curled from her mouth as though it produced a distasteful sensation. Why do you sell these golas to the witches and then kill the golas? Waff pressed his lips together and remained silent. You have somehow changed this gola while still making it possible for him to regain his original memories, she said. You know so much, Waff said. It was not quite a sneer, and he hoped revealed nothing. Spies. She had spies among the witches. Was there also a traitor in the Tlilazu heartlands? There is a girl child on Rakkis who figures in the plans of the witches, the honored mater said. How do you know this? The witches do not make a move without our knowing. You think of spies, but you cannot know how far our arms will reach. Waff was dismayed. Could she read his mind? Was it something born of the scattering? A wild talent from out there, where the original human seed could not observe? How have you changed this gola? She demanded. Voice. Waff, armed against such devices by his mentat teacher, almost blurted an answer. This honored mater had some of the witch's powers. It had been so unexpected coming from her. You expected such things from a reverend mother, and were prepared. He was a moment recovering his balance. Waff steepled his hands in front of his chin. You have interesting resources, she said. A gamine expression came over Waff's features. He knew how disarmingly elf-like he could look. Attack. We know how much you have learned from the Bene Gesserit, she said. A look of rage swept over her face and was gone. They have taught us nothing. Waff pitched his voice at a humorously appealing level, cajoling. Surely this is not bargaining. Isn't it? She actually appeared surprised. Waff lowered his hands. Come now, honored mater. You are interested in this gola. You speak of things on Rakkis. What do you take us for? Very little. You become less valuable by the instant.
Waff sensed the coldest machine logic in her response. There was no smell of mentat in it, but something more chilling. She is capable of killing me right here. Where were her weapons? Would she even require weapons? He did not like the look of those stringy muscles, the calluses on her hands, the hunter's gleam in her orange eyes. Could she possibly guess or even know about the dart throwers in his sleeves? We are confronted by a problem that cannot be resolved by logical means, she said. Waff stared at her in shock. A Zen Sunni master might have said that. He had said it himself on more than one occasion. You have probably never considered such a possibility, she said. It was as though her words dropped a mask away from her face. Waff suddenly saw through to the calculating person behind these postures. Did she take him for some pad-footed sealy fit only for collecting slig shit? Bringing as much hesitant puzzlement into his voice as possible, he asked, How could such a problem be resolved? The natural course of events will dispose of it, she said. Waff continued to stare at her in simulated puzzlement. Her words did not smack of revelation. Still, the things implied.
He said, Your words leave me floundering. Humankind has become infinite, she said. That is the true gift of the scattering. Waff fought to conceal the turmoil these words created. Infinite universes, infinite time, anything may happen, he said. Ah, you are a bright little mannequin, she said.
How does one allow for anything? It is not logical. She sounded, Waff thought, like one of the ancient leaders of the Butlerian Jihad, which had tried to rid humankind of mechanical minds. This honored mater was strangely out of date. Our ancestors looked for an answer with computers, he ventured. Let her try that. You already know that computers lack infinite storage capacity, she said. Again, her words disconcerted him.
Could she actually read minds? Was this a form of mind printing? What the Tlilazu did with face dancers and golas, others might do as well. He centered his awareness and concentrated on Ixians, on their evil machines, Pawinda machines. The honored mater swept her gaze around the room. Are we going to trust the Ixians? She asked. Waff held his breath. I don't think you fully trust them, she said. Come, come, little man. I offer you my goodwill. Belatedly, Waff began to suspect that she was trying to be friendly and candid with him. She certainly had put aside her earlier pose of angry superiority. Waff's informants from the Lost Ones said the honored maters made sexual decisions much in the manner of the Bene Gesserit. Was she trying to be seductive? But she clearly understood and had exposed the weakness of logic. It was very confusing.
We are talking in circles, he said. Quite the contrary. Circles enclose. Circles limit. Humankind no longer is limited by the space in which to grow. There she went again. He spoke past a dry tongue. It is said that what you cannot control, you must accept. She leaned forward, the orange eyes intent on his face. Do you accept the possibility of a final disaster for the Bene Tlilax? If that were the case, I would not be here. When logic fails, another tool must be used. Waff grinned. That sounds logical. Don't mock me! How dare you! Waff lifted his hands defensively and assumed a placating tone. What tool would the honored mater suggest? Energy! Her answer surprised him. Energy? In what form and how much?
You demand logical answers, she said.
With a feeling of sadness, Waff realized that she was not, after all, Zen Suni. The honored mater only played word games on the fringes of non-logic, circling it, but her tool was logic. Rot at the core spreads outward, he said.
It was as though she had not heard his testing statement. There is untapped energy in the depths of any human we deign to touch, she said. She extended a skeletal finger to within a few meters of his nose. Waff pulled back into his chair until she dropped her arm.
He said, Is that not what the Bene Gesserit said before producing their Kwisatz Haderach? They lost control of themselves and of him, she sneered.
Again, Waff thought, she employed logic in thinking of the non-logical. How much she had told him in these little lapses. He could glimpse the probable history of these honored maters. One of the natural Reverend Mothers from the Fremen of Rakis had gone out in the scattering. Diverse people had fled on the no-ships during and immediately after the famine times. A no-ship had seeded the Wild Witch and her concept somewhere. That seed had returned in the form of this orange-eyed huntress. Once more she hurled voice at him, demanding, What have you wrought with this Gola? This time Waff was prepared and shrugged it off. This honored mater would have to be deflected, or if possible, slain. He had learned much from her, but there was no way of telling how much she had learned from him with her unguessed talents. They are sexual monsters, his informants had said. They enslave men by the powers of sex. How little you know the joys I could give you, she said. Her voice coiled like a whip around him. How tempting, how seductive. Waff spoke defensively.
Tell me why you...
I need tell you nothing.
Then you did not come to bargain. He spoke sadly. The no-ships had indeed seeded those other universes with rot. Waff sensed the weight of necessity on his shoulders. What if he could not slay her?
How dare you keep suggesting a bargain with an honored mater, she demanded. Know you that we set the price.
I do not know your ways, honored mater, Waff said. But I sense in your words that I have offended. Apology accepted.
No apology intended. He stared at her blandly. Many things could be deduced from her performance. Out of his millennial experiences, Waff reviewed what he had learned here. This female from the scattering came to him for an essential piece of information. Therefore, she had no other source. He sensed desperation in her, well masked, but definitely there. She needed confirmation or refutation of something she feared. How like a predatory bird she was, sitting there with her claw hands so lightly on the arms of her chair. Rot at the core spreads outward. He had said it, and she had not heard. Clearly, atomic humankind continued to explode on its scatterings of scatterings. The people represented by this honored mater had not found a way to trace the no-ships. That was it, of course. She hunted the no-ships, just as the witches of the Bene Gesserit did.
You seek the way to nullify a no-ship's invisibility, he said.
The statement obviously rocked her. She had not expected this from the elf-like mannequin seated in front of her. He saw fear, then anger, then resolution pass across her features before she resumed her predatory mask. She knew, though. She knew he had seen.
So that is what you do with your gola, she said.
It is what the witches of the Bene Gesserit seek with him, Waff lied.
I underestimated you, she said. Did you make the same mistake with me?
I do not think so, honored mater. The breeding scheme that produced you was quite obviously formidable. I think you could kick out a foot and kill me before I blinked an eye. The witches are not in the same league with you. A smile of pleasure softened her features. Are the Tlilazu to be our willing servants, or compelled? He did not try to hide outrage.
You offer us slavery?
That is one of your options.
He had her now. Arrogance was her weakness. Submissively, he asked,
What would you command me to do?
You will take back as your guests two younger honored maters. They are to be bred with you and teach you our ways of ecstasy. Waff inhaled and exhaled two slow breaths. Are you sterile? She asked.
Only our face dancers are mules. She would already know that. It was common knowledge. You call yourself master, she said. Yet you have not mastered yourself.
More than you, honored mater, bitch. And I call myself Marshik, a fact that may yet destroy you.
The two honored maters I send with you will make an inspection of everything Tlilazu, and return to me with a report, she said. He sighed as though in resignation.
Are the two younger women comely?
Honored maters, she corrected him.
Is that the only name you use?
If they choose to give you names, that is their privilege, not yours. She leaned sideways and rapped a bony knuckle against the floor. Metal gleamed in her hand. She had a way of penetrating this room's shielding. The hatch opened, and two women dressed much like his honored mater entered. Their dark capes carried less decoration, and both women were younger. Waff stared at them. He tried not to show a... He failed. No matter. The older one would think he admired the beauty of these two. By signs known only to the masters, he saw that one of the two newcomers was a new face dancer. a successful exchange had been made, and these scattered ones could not detect it. Tetzlilazu had successfully passed a hurdle. Would the Bene Gesserit be as blind to these new Golas? You are being sensibly agreeable about this, for which you will be rewarded, the old honored mater said.
I recognize your powers, honored mater, he said. That was true. He bowed his head to conceal the resolution that he knew he could not keep from his eyes.
She gestured to the newcomers. These two will accompany you. Their slightest whim is your command. They will be treated with all honor and respect.
Of course, honored mater.
Keeping his head bowed, he lifted both arms as though in salutation and submission. A dart hissed from each sleeve. As he released the darts, Waff jerked himself sideways in his chair. The motion was not quite rapid enough. The old mater's right foot shot out, catching him in the left thigh and hurling him backward on his chair. It was the old honored mater's last living act. The dart from his left sleeve caught her in the back of her throat, entering through her opened mouth, a mouth left gaping in surprise. Narcotic poison cut off any outcry. The other dart hit the non-face dancer of the newcomers in the right eye. His face dancer accomplice cut off any warning shout by a blurred chop to the throat. Two bodies slumped in death. Painfully, Waff disentangled himself from the chair and righted it as he got to his feet. His thigh throbbed. A fraction of a meter more, and she would have broken his thigh. He realized that her reaction had not been mediated by her central nervous system. As with some insects, attack could be initiated by the required muscle system. That development would have to be investigated. His face dancer accomplice was listening at the open hatch. She stepped aside to allow the entry of another face dancer in the guise of an Ixian guard. Waff massaged his inner thigh while his face dancers disrobed the dead woman. The one who copied the Ixian put her head to that of the dead old honored mater. Things moved swiftly after that. Presently there was no Ixian guard, only a faithful copy of the old honored mater and a younger honored mater attendant. Another pseudo-Ixian entered and copied the younger, honored mater. Soon there were only ashes where dead flesh had been. A new honored mater scooped the ashes into a bag and concealed it beneath her robe. Waff made a careful examination of the room. The consequences of discovery made him shudder. Such arrogance as he had seen here came from obviously awesome powers. Those powers must be probed.
He detained the face dancer who had copied the old one. You have printed her?
Yes, master. Her waking memories were still alive when I copied.
Transfer to her. He gestured to the one who had been an Ixian guard. They touched foreheads for a few heartbeats, then parted.
It is done, said the older one.
How many other copies of these honored maters have we made?
Four, master.
None of them detected?
None, master.
Those four must return to the heartland of these honored maters and learn all there is to know about them. One of those four must get back to us with what is learned,